I suggest you just get a job. My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here tonight. Some years ago in the Navy, we put in a Hong Kong right after the war. One of the big occasions there, because it's all made of a lot of bamboo huts at that time, a lot of wooden things, and they always have a danger of some big flame sweeping over the city. And so they do a lot of work against that in Hong Kong. And somehow tonight, during the course of this meeting, I hadn't thought about that for many years, but tonight at this meeting, I got the impression I was back at some kind of a Chinese fire drill. But I may remember it wrong, I don't know. I was glad to see that there's been a missionary here from Pasadena, because as long as I've been sober, in Pasadena and the San Gabriel Valley, they read the Al-Anon prayer at the beginning of every meeting. And no one over there has been sober long enough to remember why. I hope it doesn't presage the same thing now that they've brought us to this meeting. I'm more glad to hear the Al-Anon prayer at a meeting, and it helps me remember that there are other organizations. I'm not certainly against Al-Anon. My wife is a secretary of an Al-Anon group, and I sometimes take her calls. And I tell them the same thing I tell Click: get a job. How long are you going to bleed that man white? But I am happy to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober. I was thinking of Mary Lou talking. I'm always pleased when Mary Lou talks. And tonight she had two clocks in the 13 minutes. Just holding them like that is no good. You got to just... I don't know. I'm a little tired tonight. I'm afraid by the time I get done, I'm going to be charming and warm. But Mary Lou talked tonight, and this is a very natural thing. She said she was quite screwed up, and that's natural. People get screwed up around here. But I had a chuckle to myself, because right in that little place, I'm sitting there between the step reader, Bob, who read chapter 5, and Maurice, who read the traditions, and myself, the speaker. Between us, we've had 101 electric shock treatments. True story. And you think you're screwed up. I got one thing I couldn't understand. When Bob was new at our end of town, I was talking one night, and I mentioned that I'd had 48 electric shock treatments at one time when I was incarcerated as a hopeless case in the state of Texas. And over in the side, I heard, "Son of a bitch," because he'd had 45 and had been able to really impress people with that number. Maurice only had 8, but he's an author. So I guess it's all right to be screwed up from time to time. I was thinking about that yesterday about noon. I was standing in the middle of a small sandstorm down in central Texas. And I was looking up, and at just about the right time of day you can do this. Up on the second floor of an old red brick building, there's some heavy screens and some bars. You can't see in. But when the light's from the south and you're standing on the north side of the building looking at what you can see silhouettes. And that particular ward is the electric shock ward of the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. And yesterday, noon, I was looking up there, and I don't know how many of you have ever been on an intensive electroshock in a state hospital ward, but when you're on intensive electric shock, you don't really do much, because you don't know your name, you don't know where you are, you don't know what's going on, you just go over automatically to look at the list in the morning and see if your name's on it, and you don't know why. You don't even know why you're looking. It's kind of funny, but it isn't funny. Then you spend most of the day, you walk to this wall, then you turn around and you walk to that wall. Then you turn around and walk to this wall until somebody gets you and takes you to eat. I was watching those silhouettes against that window yesterday noon, watching them shuffle this way and shuffle that way. And they're sick, gone, mentally incompetent, frightening, horrible sight. And it's kind of a shocking feeling, a terrible feeling, because you look at that and you know, you poor bastards, you don't have a chance. No matter what happens, you'll never get back. And that's why I said it was kind of, it's always touching to me. Whenever I get a chance, and I'm going to, in the South, I make it a point of my own expense to stop off in Midland, Texas, where the airport is, and I have a friend of mine drive me 40 miles over that insane asylum if I could stand in that and watch those people, because just about 20 years ago, I was one of those silhouettes, and there was no way I could get off that. And I was not up there for being an alcoholic. Nothing on my commitment paper said alcoholism. My commitment paper said mentally incompetent, unable to live in his society. And what brought it on was because I just, in a terrible fit of depression, while sober, I had committed suicide in El Paso. And a neighbor pounded on my chest till I got my heart started, and they talked to me and realized there was no hope for me, and put me away for an indefinite period, up to and perhaps including the rest of my life. And so I always like to stand there. There's no hardly anybody around there I can talk to. I go in and talk on the alcoholic ward there, too. They always tell me I'm the only one who ever, anyone who's ever been through that hospital or comes back and talks to the patients. And they think I'm a dedicated, wonderful man. But I'm not a dedicated, wonderful man at all. I always leave that hospital glad I came. I had to speak last night at a, they celebrated the anniversary of Bill Wilson's sobriety date in Dallas last night, and they had a big thing for the central office, and a lot of enormous room full of nice people and well-dressed and handsome and glittering and the beautiful folk of AA Dallas. And it was nice, but that's kind of just like talking. The meaningful experience of my week was watching those silhouettes go back and forth across that window. Because left to my own devices, doing what the best I can do and using the best judgment I can muster, I must surely be there or someplace like it. Or even worse than that, to be on the street in agony. Sometimes you talk to an Alcoholics Anonymous about how tough it's been. I've been in this institution and that institution. I've been in some institutions too. I've been in one or two institutions. I've been in jail a number of times. I've been in insane asylum, been in the Veterans Hospital, been in a lot of places. And I'll tell you something. They make for pretty talk, but the worst place that I've ever been is living on the street in the world, pretending I had it all together day after day when my gut was dropping out. At least in an institution, you're protected against the conflict. Whenever I was locked up in an institution, I stopped biting my nails and I gained weight, even though I hated it. How did you get out of there? When I look back, I always gained weight and stopped biting my nails. When I got back out and straightened out and reformed and back in the advertising agency or back on the faculty of the University of Texas or back somewhere, the heat was on and the pressure's on. And I didn't know what the hell was wrong with me. I knew what wasn't wrong with me. I knew that one of the things that a number of people thought were wrong with me A lot of people thought I had a problem with alcohol. And I knew I didn't. And I knew I didn't because my worst problem sometimes came when I was not drinking. That's why I drank. Now, if your problem is alcohol, you're supposed to get drunk and have trouble and get sober and feel wonderful. Everybody knows that. You go to an AA meeting, that's the way it sounded to me. I stayed drunk. It's just terrible. And one day I came through that door. As though a load of pain dropped from me. I haven't had a bad thought since that day. And if you're like me, you just kind of sit in the back row and think, "Ah, shit." Well, is that there? My problem does not consist of that. And I used to wish it did. I wished it did in Texas. And I wished it did in the state I was in before Texas. And I wished it did the state I was in before that. And I wished it did the state I was in before that. And the jobs and the opportunities and the starts and the reformations. I've made so many reformations, I thought I had a unique and complex personality, and I never stopped to evaluate it, but I noticed certain trends in it. And the trends in my life are, when I'm good, I want to be bad. And when I'm bad, I want to be good. And it doesn't leave you many places to rest. It really doesn't. You know, it's been said many times, but you know, I don't know anybody better than Chuck C., who says it any better about the story of the prodigal son who lays in the husks and the swine. And his father, the Lord, says, "Come home and be the son of the Lord." He hesitates and he's sore afraid, as they say. But his father came, he comes home finally full of trepidation. His father bathes his body with oils and dresses him in expensive raiment and sits him at his right hand at the table. And the boy is frightened and shy. He's been bad. And they kill the fatted calf, and he becomes again the son of the Lord. And I'll tell you something. That's happened to me as surely as anything I've ever had. And it's happened to me a number of times. My only difficulty identifying with the prodigal son is just as we finish off stopping our bread in the gravy of the fatted calf, some goddamn hogs start calling. Come on, we got a new ship in the house. I wouldn't mind being over there, and I wouldn't mind being over here, but that going back and forth with this enthusiasm. And as I've always known I've had some problems. I knew from the time I was a boy. When I was a boy, they thought I was too brilliant for our school. And so they shoved me ahead. In the 1930s, they didn't have special schools in Montessori classes. In small towns in Wisconsin, they just shoved your head till you got to where you could read as fast as the kids in that class. But if they didn't shove me ahead, the kids all got big. And I was small and felt inadequate. And there were some domestic problems in our family. And I was instinctively bright enough to play my mother against my father, so I never had any discipline from the time I was 11 on. And I was raised in a very, very strict church that gave me one of the strongest ethics anybody has ever seen. The Norwegian Lutheran ethic, there is none stronger. I hear sometimes in AA people say things like, "Catholicism and its strictness drove me to drink."
I'll tell you something. In Eau Claire, Wisconsin, if you were too weak to make it as a Lutheran, you could always be a Catholic. And it gave me a very strong ethic. One I could not live up to, but a strong one. Perhaps I misinterpreted what they tried to teach me, but I know that whenever I'm being good, my standards are terribly high. I know I got two speeds, good and bad. And the good is high and the bad is low. I tell you, and I try to do something about it, and I can't. And all of my life, as I say, I know I've had some problems. I've had problems in adjusting to my environment. Once upon a time, I spent several $1,000s with a psychiatrist, and he gave me a number of reasons for it. It didn't change my feelings, but I could explain them better. I'm not putting it down at all, but in looking back over that money I spent in psychiatrist, I would say roughly, it boiled down to what he told me about what I should do with my life. He said, he didn't ever say these words. He spread it out over many, many weeks. But I think the nubbin of his advice was that I should learn to accept the fact that life has its ups and life has its downs. Well, I was glad to hear that. I began to read philosophy then, hoping to further exploit this breakthrough. I read a lot of Nietzsche and Schopenhauer and Immanuel Kant, because when you are a pseudo-intellectual, you have to be up on these things. I was so glad my eyes were bad, I was afraid I was going to have to get dark horn-rimmed glasses without lenses. I had intermittent successes in my life where my reformation drove me to neurotic intensities. Like I said, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. That's correct. I did the dramatic Gresham staging of a grand opera. Beautiful thing. Except a month later, I was in the nut house in Texas. And a few months later, they looked at my record. I was coming off shock treatments. They looked at my record and saw I directed an opera. So my next directing assignment was directing the Christmas pageant at the Texas Nut House. That was a lot of laughs, you know. I've said this many times, but it's still true. My major project there was trying to keep the three wise men off the Virgin Mary to get that personal thing. No, Lamar Jean, you're supposed to worship her.
Oh, what are you?
It's funnier in the telling than in the doing, really. And I started the hospital newspaper because I wanted to be on top of it. And a few months after that, I got out by simulating alcoholic problem. And I got in their alcoholic ward, finally, out of the psychiatric ward. I finally got out. And a few months after that, I was in Dallas, the largest advertising agency in the South, working on the LC&L Murray ads for the Borden Company. And I had a big success. I had a lovely home, a block from the SMU campus in Highland Park, and I was doing good. And a few months after that, unfortunately, I woke up and I was in the Phoenix drunk tank, and the guy just kicked my teeth down my throat because I'd vomited on his bunk. Which is, with my psychiatric training, I was able to identify that as overreaction. I know that. And it just went on and on like this. Before I came to Texas and became a success, I was playing piano in a whorehouse in San Francisco. And nothing wrong with that except it's hard to work in your resume. You know, and before that, I was an advertising executive in the Midwest with plaques and awards. You know, just no rest. I'm going to tell you something. I'll If you're new tonight, I'm going to tell you probably the greatest single example. My assistant, Dr. Blake, here from Oceanside, has just called something to my attention, and I'm going to show you what security is. Very few people can do this. I'm going to zip up my trousers. Now, I guess it's just an instinctive thing. Rob, who is visiting from West Germany, is a lieutenant colonel, and when I sit next to military people, I think military thoughts, right? That zipper is at half mast. I'm in the dead soldier that they buried there. Yeah. Anyway. I don't know why they put me away, do you? But as far back as I can remember, when I have senses in imbalance, I discovered something in the Pacific Ocean when I was 15 years old in 1943, and I was going south on the loaded torpedo warhead, so I wanted to see if it was outside Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And I found out with a vengeance, but I was on the Pacific, and I discovered a guy gave me some whiskey, and it made me sick. And about a week later, I finally held a drink of whiskey down. And that whiskey that day transformed my relationship to my environment. And I did fine for about 5 minutes, but I got sick and threw up. But for 5 minutes, I had the feeling that it looked to me like everybody else had, and I was deprived of because of my sensitivity. And for the rest of my life, I drank alcohol to reduce the imbalances that came in sobriety. I've often said this, and I guess it's true. Alcohol is the best friend I ever had in my life. Women come and go. Families come and go. Parents come and go. Jobs come and go. States come and go. Approaches to life come and go. Intentions come and go. Determinations come and go. Resolves come and go. But a drink continued to resolve the imbalance that I could not understand, and I could not live with in my gut. And I could not identify the feelings. But the feelings were, if someone would have asked me to put a lie detector on my arm and said, what is your problem as you see it? Probably the number one thing I would think of is, somehow I seem to have been born more sensitive than other people, and I don't understand why. It seems to me that other people can take things in stride that get me worked up. And I seem to react more to people, and I'm more sensitive to being put down by people. And I'm more loving, and therefore I'm more crushed when I'm rejected or something. So it makes me hate people for rejecting me. And if I could just find some place where sensitive emotions are understood, if I could just get a handle on it. Because they're not always there. Some days I feel fine, but some days I don't feel fine, and I can't explain because it looks to me like everything else is the same, but one day everything just goes to hell. And people look funny, and they act different, and I know it must be something wrong inside of me, but I don't know what it is. I can't find anybody to tell me what it is. And I found a doctor who told me what he thought it was, but even after I knew it, it didn't help. Still, the sun would come up some days, and I wanted to run. And some days, the job that I loved so much, just I felt I was being used and exploited. And some days, the children, and some days I sat and cried with my love. I just looked at them and thought, what kind of unnatural goddamn things are these? Why can't they be right? and this crappy town and this crappy job, and they're using me, and I'm sick and tired of having people exploit me. And when your feelings are hurting bad enough, and you withdraw, and the corollary to those kind of feelings, the sensitivity, of course, that I've discovered in my life, I've been thinking a great deal about this lately. I don't know why. Maybe because I didn't think about it much before. And it struck me a few months ago, and I was talking to a new guy, and he was telling me about something, and I was trying to share some experiences with him, and it suddenly struck me that probably as I look back over my life, the number one painful, pain-causing, destructive force in my emotions that I've ever had, the continual disintegration of me, is not suicidal traumas, is not great depressions, is not great estrangements, but something so picky in as you can hardly say it without sneering. But this one thing has cost me more than everything else put together. Just getting my feelings hurt. Because when I get my feelings hurt, baby, I gotta go one of two ways. I gotta hurt you back, or I gotta withdraw to punish you. That's the two alternatives I got. And some days you don't notice getting your feelings hurt, but when you're sensitive in some days and things are kind of funny, and that hole is back in your gut, and the wind is blowing through, and you're trying to reform, and you jump into your Buick convertible to go to your office with a rug on the floor, and you feel like instead you should drive down to a toilet and stick your head in it because you just feel terrible. And then somebody says something to you like, "Hey, that copy that you wrote, we can't use that." Now some days I realize they mean, they can't use that copy. But sometimes it becomes a personal vendetta. And I say, "Well, son of a bitch, if you don't use it, get yourself another boy." And you know what happens? They get another boy. And my children hurt my feelings, and so I punish them by withdrawing me from them. And my family hurts my feelings, and the neighbors hurt my feelings, and my friends hurt my feelings, so I change bars, or change friends, or change whatever. So I got two ways to go. Either to hurt you back a little bit worse, so to teach you not to hurt my feelings, or else to get away from you. And eventually when they're like that, you always have to get away because you've never got enough clout to get even with all of them. Now, I discovered that drinking eases off those feelings. And drinking eases off my feelings of being estranged sometimes. And sometimes some days when the waves of inadequacy, you know, and sports, they talk about the pressure being on and the old hand coming out of the shirt and choke, choke when the pressure's on. And I understand that. I know that having a couple drinks makes that hand release. Having a few drinks gets a sensitive person through. Having a few drinks gives you a chance to maybe get your thoughts together. Now, drinking, as far back as I can remember, is the most therapeutic help I've ever had. So I spent a lot of time in analysis. I had a lot of time in reading philosophy. I got into metaphysics before metaphysics were big. One time, only six of us knew truth in the whole state of Texas. I was strongly religiously trained, and I followed those therapies, plus AA, that I went to intermittently for years, even though I was not truly an alcoholic. All those therapies put together do not have as much effect on me as a single double shot. That or a big martini, or a glass of wine, or a little bit of scotchy pool, or something that will take the edge off. Now, sometimes, when you're under a lot of pressure, when you're creative, and the heat is on, and sometime when you're getting a lot of the wrong ends of the stick, wrong end again. Sometimes when people are looking at you funny, sometimes when the tension is back and you can't find out why, some days when you wake up afraid and there's no goddamn way to talk to about anybody about it because you don't know what you're afraid of, so you can't say, I'm afraid. What are you afraid of? Me? Don't tell them. Just, I'm fine. How are you, bitch? How are you? How did you get off my case? Now, sometimes when the pressure's too much, even social drinkers drink too much. Because I need the relief. And then I drink too much sometimes. Because I need that relief. And I get drunk. And as the years went by and the imbalances between my inside and outside mounted, I needed more to drink. And some people really thought I had a drinking problem. And they would come to me and say things like, why don't you do something about your drinking problem? And as soon as they said that, I knew they didn't understand, really. Because I didn't really have a drinking problem. But that's what they could see on the outside and smell, because you couldn't see where it hurt. And you can't... Years ago, some of these guys remember this, I was used to tell them, on my first Christmas sober, my children were living in Dallas, and I was living in an abandoned car back at the 6300 Club, and I got a job as a janitor, and I got fired because the guy thought I was going to steal his watches. And he was absolutely right. I'd have made amends later. But I just needed something to get me through. So I didn't have much money. I had about $14, and I wanted to send my fourth daughter something in Dallas. I had a post office box number. So I went over to 50 Grubs on the other corner. They had some little animals at Christmas, and there were little lions and tigers and little hippopotamus and little elephants, and they were very cute. So I got 14 of them. And somebody said they'd mail them if I'd get them all ready to mail. So I put little notes around them, fun little rhymes and cute little things, and I had tears of devotion in my eyes. I really did. I'd been sober 40 days, and I knew I wouldn't be sober much longer because I'd been in and out of AA for 8-9 years by this time, and it only worked for alcoholics anyway. And I was just waiting to get a score to get out of town. And this one lion, I was writing it up, and I just looked at him. It was a funny thing. Up close, he looked okay on the shelf, but up close, he was cockeyed. And I looked at him, and somehow his seams were about a quarter of an inch off, all the way around. And his tail was off, that was kind of a... And I thought, I've been screwed. He looked all right on the shelf, you know. And it suddenly... What suddenly happened to me, I identified with that lion. I sent 13 animals to Dallas that year. And that lion stayed wherever I was for years and years. So just a couple years ago, one of our dogs chewed it apart. But everywhere I ever was, you knew where I stuck, because there was a lion. So every time I get thinking, man, I look pretty good on that shelf. I look at that little son of a bitch that reminds me. Ready to get up close, baby. You know. But I knew my problem wasn't alcohol. And sometimes, to please people over the years, I went to AA, as I said. And AA is a great place for drinkers. and people who all get together. But my problem is not like that. It is sometimes, but how do you explain to people, a lot of times it hurts even worse when I'm sober, when I'm trying to put it together, when I'm trying to fill a role that, God damn it, I just somehow can't get the handle on. I can have it some days and not have it some days. Why can't I feel like a parent, like other parents? Why do I have to take my kids to the park and look out of the corner of my eye and see what real fathers do? Why do I have to always judge and question the things I do? Either so sure that everybody's wrong or that everybody's right, but there's no in-between. I'm either above everybody some days or I'm below everybody. God damn it, why can't I ever be just like them, just with them? And it's no wonder that a person needs something to restore that imbalance. And all the lectures in the world, and all the literate ministers coming out of my jail cell, and all my mother's tears, and all my children's tears, and all my wife's tears, and all the looks of disappointment in people who befriended me, and all the people who went to bat for me and said, I'm really going out on a limb for you, so when I did it to them, it really hurt. There's never enough, because one day it just gets to be too much. And what do you do then? My problem is not alcohol. My problem is there's something wrong inside of me or with all these people, one or the other. And what am I going to do? You drink one day, if you're like me, maybe in one of your depressions, or commit suicide, go to the nut house and get shock treatments for months. Or maybe you'll just run away to the next cities. I've done a lot of times, hoping against hope. Great line. Quoted it many times. But they're all such a poignant line to me. In the last act of The Streetcar Named Desire, poor old Blanche DuBois, she's had a terrible life, and she's been just quicksawed by everybody, and they're coming to get her to put her in the nut house, finally, a rest home. And she's a quivering mass in this kindly doctor. She says, Oh, doctor, will you be kind to me, please, if I go along? He said, of course you will, Miss DuBois. She said, I pray you will, because I've always had to depend upon the kindness of strangers. And it always grabbed me, because that's always seemed to be the story of my life. Where am I going to find those strangers who will continue to be kind? Where do I go? If I ever let people see how soft I am, they'll kill me. So the worse I felt inside, the more insolent and arrogant and supercilious I got outside. Well, there's really no place to go. And at the end, knowing there is no hope for me, scar tissue on my wrist, carbon outside my lungs, despair in my heart, my family gone, my occupation gone, my front teeth gone. Now that's getting serious. And never, I remember standing outside of the blood bank on Skid Row downtown waiting to sell a pint of blood at 4 to 6 in the morning. And a cold rain falling on me, and I weighed 108 pounds, and I had no front teeth, and a t-shirt and a pair of pants and some pennies. And I was thinking, God damn it, what? I never did find out what was wrong with me. I never found out what was wrong. And that's why it's kind of unusual tonight to find myself leaping off a plane from Texas to come here at tremendous expense and no little inconvenience. Just so I can talk to you newer people and tell you something funny. A funny thing happened to me on my way to the charnel house. I found out one additional fact some time ago, and so a couple weeks ago I celebrated my 17th birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for 17 years I haven't had a drink of alcohol, and I haven't had a touch of marijuana, despite occasional little nest of those pukes who come around the program saying it's all right. I haven't had any pills, medically prescribed or otherwise, for my emotional condition. I haven't had anything in my body stronger than an aspirin since 1958. And I've come here tonight to ask you new people this question. Why can't you be sincere the way we were in the old days?
Who wanted the program back there? I walked in that darn shit. Just like,
I'm going to tell you something. I discovered over in 1958 and thereafter, over a period of time, I've only found out two important things that I've ever significantly added to the luster of my life. One is that alcohol makes things better. That's the number one thing I ever found in my life. And the second thing was, what was wrong with me when it wasn't alcohol? Because that's almost I gave up on that. And that's what I want to talk to you about just for a couple of minutes. I feel I have a few extra minutes since all the birthday cakes are out of the way. If you are worrying about your hair, why don't you write it? I just left it home. I dropped it off at the laundromat. Here. That was really funny. Last night at this thing in Dallas, through some hideous miscalculation, you had a spotlight shining on the speaker, only it just fell behind you. Your face was black, and it just dropped on my bald head. The only hope I had is that maybe the newcomers will think I've got an aura. I couldn't show my dimple to make points. But I'll tell you, when I was new in 1958, I guess they told me, because I'd been in another 8 or 9 years, I'd heard all the crap, but the basic foundation, my problem, goddammit, is not alcohol. What can I do? I can go to these meetings and I can pretend to be an alcoholic and all this baloney, but down deep, who do I turn to? And they said, if you do these things and go to meetings and get a sponsor and most everything you think will change. And I think that's true. If you do these things, most everything will change over a period of time. About the only perspective that I have never changed. Most everything I ever could look at or think about since I got sober has changed. In some cases, tremendously dramatically. For instance, I remember when I was 4 years sober how thrilled I was finally to do something I hadn't been able to do for 12 years. Order a gravestone for my son's grave that I felt I killed. It took me 12 years to get 4 years of sobriety. I went back to Wisconsin, ordered it, and saw it with a different perspective. To visit the grave of my best friend who committed suicide because of something I had done to him, said to him in public. It took me a lot of time to be able to go back and look at that nut house in Texas with a perspective other than that of terror. But all the perspective changed. There's only one perspective as I look over my life that has not changed in any essence, except to become more, my original idea is more intense now than it was in 1958. And that's this. I am more convinced tonight that alcohol was not my problem than I was in 1958. And in fact, as I often say, and it sounds terrible, but I want to say it. Since I'm the speaker, I can represent my own opinion. It is my opinion, if your problem is alcohol, you're in the wrong place. Because we can't help you. Not only we can't help you, we don't need to help you. Because people don't need help with a problem with alcohol. because there's a relatively easy solution to a problem with alcohol. It's called don't drink. If your life is all right except if you drink, don't drink. That's all there is to it. Big breakthrough, leave your money on the altar rail and dance right out. The problem here is not alcohol. If the problem were alcohol, there'd be no need for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's more comfortable to think it's alcohol and blame it all on alcohol, but just makes everybody secretly feel differently, because I never met anybody who really felt their problem was alcohol. But they feel everybody else does, so I'll go along with that crap, but my case is somewhat different. The problem here sounds like alcohol, and we talk a lot about drinking, and we talk about what's happened to us, and we talk about the terrors that we've experienced sometimes. We talk about the outbreaks of emotional despair because of drinking and so on. And you get the real impression that you're here to beat an alcohol problem. But that's not correct. And if you don't get over that, it's very likely that alcohol will kill you. If you don't stop thinking your problem is alcohol, alcohol may kill you. But if you can come to understand that alcohol is not your problem, you've got a very good chance of never having to drink alcohol again. Which sounds like a real paradox, but it really isn't. The problem, as it turns out, as I've learned from my betters, when I got so desperate I listened and did what they said instead of engage in vain pseudo-intellectual debates, dealing from absolutely no strength but never realizing it, coming out of a bashing and abandoned car without any front teeth, up to truck chambers, I think you're a fella. Shit. Now, don't misunderstand me. I didn't do it so he could hear me. That's what you call dealing out of weakness a little bit, you know. I want to tell you, the thing that has been taught to me and reinforced to me by the people ahead of me on this program whom I respect and admire, Chuck C., all the guys like him ahead of me who are active and exude good feelings that go far to overweigh the petty crossness of their detractors who do nothing but carp and shoot arrows. I have come to understand over a period of time what my problem was. It was not alcohol at all. It was something that sounded like alcohol and almost cost me my life because I thought there was no name for it. It's something called alcoholism. And the difference between a problem with alcohol and a problem with alcoholism is just the difference between whether I will live or go crazy. Because it just boils down to this. When you get sober, your problem with alcohol is over. That is how you recover from a problem with alcohol. You get sober. And you always get sober, sooner or later. Again, and again, and any one of these times you say, hey, that's enough for me. And you're cured. There are all sorts of wonderful ways to help people get sober. One of the big breakthroughs was 3 or 4 years ago. You don't hear them talk about it much more, but that's at Loma Linda University. They had the all-time breakthrough for drinking. They had a bar in the alcoholic ward and a bartender, and he served guys drinks. Have a drink. And every once in a while when they said the drink, they got a big electric shock. Next drink, they wouldn't get one. That first one, don't put that pastrilla, you know. At first, I got just like rats in a maze. You want a drink? No, I don't believe so. Now, that sounds funny, folks, but it's written up in the papers as the new cure for alcoholism devised by Loma Linda University. And there was only one that they had 100% cures. Well, anybody left that hospital? I was after one last drink, and they said, shit, no, I don't... Yeah. The only trouble was, they always seemed to find a bar where there weren't any wires on the glass. There you go. Well, I guarantee you one thing. You don't have to go to Loma Linda. You don't have to go to the Depot Center. You don't have to go to Beverly Manor. You don't have to go nowhere if you don't want to. You can get sober on the Natch again and again and again. All you need is a toilet bowl or a bucket or a wet rag. You get sober. It turns out the difference, the thing that the difference between alcohol and alcoholism is when you get sober, you recover from alcohol. But in the disease of alcoholism, when you get sober, you look as though you recover. Because then the illness goes underground into the emotions. And the curse of alcoholism that makes it deadly, more deadly than all the other allergies combined, the curse of alcoholism is that sooner or later the alcoholic must drink to save his sanity. And baby, there ain't no way out. As our book says, there seems to be a point at which there is no adequate defense against the first drink. And every alcoholic that ever lived that I ever heard of has been baffled by that. If I'm really an alcoholic, God damn it, when I get sober, why do things go to hell? Why do I have these emotions? These memories, these what might have been, the if onlys that just eat you up. If I'm really an alcoholic, why don't I really fit in when I'm sober? Why do I only fit in when I drink? Why do I only feel equal when I drink, instead of superior or inferior? Why do I only enjoy when I drink? Really? Why do I only get loose when I drink? And that's why it's a good thing to learn that. That's the most important fact I learned. I didn't learn it quite as fast as I said it tonight. But I learned it little by little in desperation with the flexible mind of the dying. And I think it's important because then we got something to hang the hook on. Baby, you aren't here to get sober. You're here to make sobriety tenable. And that's why you don't take these steps out of gratitude after everything is all right. In taking these steps slowly and painfully and laboriously, some of them are so goddamn painful when you do them, it's a dead heat whether drinking is worse or this cure is worse. Right by inventory. I prefer not to think about it. Make an amend to that foul Corsican son of a bitch. I'll make an amend with a hot anvil up his nose. Turn my problems over to God. That includes this $105 in hot checks. And what God does with hot checks, he turns them over to Sheriff Peter Pitches. I don't even believe you, and you're still doing it to me. That's why it's kind of unusual. Find myself here tonight. I know of, no place else in the world, no job, no nothing, where I would turn around. I've come off the road to drive down here for no money, property, or prestige to talk to a bunch of people who may not see you again. Doesn't make a difference, really. Because this is the only thing in the world that has never disillusioned me when I did it. I have never had any person, place, or force which did not eventually disillusion the standards I set for it. This thing, our thing, I guess if we were in Italy, we'd have to say Cosa Nostra. Our thing is the only thing that by the time I got desperate enough to do it and to surrender my judgment to my betters, even though I was absolutely convinced my judgment was superior about me. But it began to work, and now it's been a number of years, and I haven't had a breakdown. It doesn't get better immediately. It gets better some days and gets worse some days, when you're new especially. Christ, the winds blow up and down. And that's why you cannot rely upon your tattered emotional judgments to prophesy what is right and what is not right. Because one of the strange things about this illness, the destructive forces and the positive forces come bubbling out of the same spring in the back of your head, and somehow you've got to keep them separated, but you now look the same. I think God wants me to knock you on your ass. Yeah. I think God wants me to quit this job, don't you, God?
Right.
I think God wants me to open a vein in my back. That's why most of us, like me, have had to find a sponsor with whom I could slowly become honest enough to let him know how weak I really was. The hardest job in my life is to strip off the protective layers of insolence to just one person and open that sick, tattered, broken armor and say, look, the guy inside is just a spindly, pale little thing trying to move him arms and legs and talk in a low tone of voice. For Christ's sake, don't tell anybody. And then by little bit, you do that and develop an empathy. Probably the nicest thing I know in AA. It isn't that you get families or jobs or you get these things, I guess, if your head's put together. But little by little, the imbalance between the inside and the outside reduces. I would say the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, based on my own experience over a period of time, and I certainly came here something less than a starry-eyed idealist, the purpose of AA is to do exactly the same thing that alcohol is to do. To work me towards feeling equal and to help me refrain from feeling different and estranged all of my life. And if you can get that, everything else is secondary. And we forget it sometimes. And sometimes we get feeling good, and it's very dangerous. Because you might look back and remember this. Emotional pain can never be recreated. If no human being can remember how bad they felt. They remember I felt bad, it was terrible. But you cannot recreate emotions. And so the human mind has something called, for some psychologists called dynamic memory. The tendency to blot out unpleasant memories and reinforce pleasant memories, which enable people to maintain their sanity over a period of a life, but which can destroy us. Because it really wasn't so bad as I thought it was back there. And I see it all clearly now. And why should I continue to keep going through this rather second-rate social charade called Alcoholics Anonymous? That is funny, except people 35 years get drunk, 35 years sober, and 30 years sober, and 25 years sober, and 20 years sober, and 10 years sober, and 7 years sober, and 4 years sober. And nearly always boils down to the same thing. Thanks, gang, but I'll take it from here. And I get right back little by little without the reinforcement to establish the parameters of my safety and my emotions. And I watch people, and everybody gets dingy in AA. Sometimes, if you stay sober long enough, you have dingy days and dingy periods because the stimuli cannot be controlled. Strange things happen in the world sometimes. And when they don't, they look like they do. And it's just, some days you just want to call for your wash pan and say, I wash my hands of all of you. Crucify everybody! Yeah! And sometimes the only way I can get you folks shaped up is to go to a meeting and eat dinner and get a good night's sleep. Sometimes that shapes you up. But sometimes I have to keep doing the same things I had to do 17 years ago. And that is, try to adjust myself to the realities of sobriety so that I am no longer a stranger in my own life. I, in the
the last 2 minutes I'm going to talk.
I'll tell you.
It's just I got my family back, and that's nice. And I feel younger now than I did in my 20s. Every Saturday, I go out and play ball in the park, which I was too old to do when I was 28. And now I'm out playing ball, and I just feel young and dynamic. But the only thing that really gets to me is I hear a little voice say, "Strike him out, Grandpa." That restores me to sanity rather quickly. And I've had some successful jobs in my sobriety, as successful as I wanted to be for the tab I was willing to pay. I could have had more.
Unfortunately, that concludes Clancy's November 30th, 1975 talk at the Crown Valley speaker meeting in Laguna Niguel. They ran out of tape.
But this is the first retreat I've ever attended. I've never attended a retreat before. And I didn't want to attend this one because I've always had kind of a subconscious joking attitude towards retreats of, I know how to retreat, I'm trying to find a way to go forward.
Clancy's 4-tape 12-step series, now available on Pacific Coast Tapes.